My name is Craig Schneider, and welcome to another episode of Half-Ashed. And now, since I've done this three times, I have completely forgotten my normal cadence. It's the 197th time. I've got a co-host. I'm bad at doing this. But Kip's here. Hey, Kip. How you doing?
I'm at least half here. You can hear me. Can't see. I feel like I'm in parentheses or something.
Well, it's the 197th show and a half. So you're allowed to have one of those without video. We'll let it slide.
Yeah, okay. I've had two or three already, but we'll go with that.
Well, I hear it is the 5th of July, 2019. This is officially our 197th episode. You are not 1,850 miles southeast of me. You are 1,100 miles south-southeast of me. And we are coming to you live on this 5th day of July. Mr. Fisher, how the heck are you?
Now, did you just remember that number, or did you actually go back and look that up?
No, I remembered that, actually. I did it for 120 episodes, probably.
That's true.
I know. I even have a, wow, that was professional in the chat room. I'm very glad you can't read sarcasm on text.
Yeah, there may be a little something lost.
Oh, no. Well, how the heck are you, buddy?
I'm good. I am sitting on American soil right now. I'm just happy as a clam.
They arrested you and put you in the American consulate?
Yeah, they deported me.
Gibbs been deported. Oh, well. Well, yeah. What are you doing back in the States?
Just visiting friends and family, sponsors. Got back in yesterday and got a 3 more weeks, I guess. So I'm overstuffed with bad food and lethargic, getting a word out here and there. No, I'm just teasing. I am literally just happy as a pig in poop to be back in the U.S. for a little bit.
I was half tempted to just like flick the picture on the screen of you to see if I could get you to add a little volume and speed it up.
Yeah. Just wait, like if we do a show while I'm in Tennessee and I re-inherit the accent, which I was accused of last year.
Would one be able to infer from that you believe you don't have an accent?
Yeah, most of mine's gone.
Huh. And who was it that told you that? Your wife, who also doesn't have an accent?
No, she does.
Oh, no kidding. Shall I put this in text so you don't pick up my sarcasm?
No, I that's true. That's real. That's a thing.
It is a thing. You gain more of your accent when you're back in Tennessee, which you will be in a couple of weeks or a week, correct?
In a week, yeah. A week from yesterday. We're only in Florida for a little less than a week.
And you, how does that go in the Fisher household? Do you appreciate the idea of in-laws, or are you making the necessary visit, the contribution to the in-law fund, so to speak?
No, I get along pretty well with my in-laws. I always have. I mean, if I didn't at this point, after 25 years, it'd be a non-issue anyway. But yeah,
well, I can't complain.
I got blessed with pretty good in-laws. Now, there may be times I've gotten into trouble because I have a father-in-law who can be irritable at times, and I might pick at scabs sometimes. I used to, man, Christy is still to this day will get irritated when she even talks about it. But for years, this is a stupid story. It has no business in a cigar podcast, but I'm going to tell it anyway. We to go to the airport in Knoxville, it's kind of south of the city, and we would sometimes need to go pick someone up or drop off or whatever. And there's a stretch of the road, the interstate. You come off a bridge and one lane ends, and then immediately, not 50 yards after that lane ends, a lane starts as a turning lane to get off the exit. And so we would go through there, and one time her dad just made some little mention. He's like, I don't know why they didn't just leave that as a lane and turn it into a turning lane. Why do they need to end it and then immediately start another one? And so from that day forward, for a solid decade or more, every time we go out there, I say, you know, man, I don't know why they ended that lane and just start another one. It's stupid. It's just they're making people come in and try to merge and get back out. And it was, and he would go on a rant for 30 minutes about that dang lane. And Christy and her mom would be so pissed off because I got him set off about that stupid lane. And I did it every time for over a decade. And she said, finally, Christy's brother told him I was messing with him when I did that. So I couldn't do it anymore.
10 years for them to finally admit that you were messing with him? Oh, mm-hmm. Poor guy. You had the run of the roost for a while there.
I loved it. It was hilarious, but Christy and her mom never thought it was as funny as I did.
Oh, that's all right. If he goes off about someone striping the lanes of a highway in a manner that he finds to be unsatisfactory, my guess is he also has a chair on that porch of yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's practically kin.
Me and Christy are from East Tennessee. It could be a thing.
She had to change her name before you guys got married, so she would have to change it again.
So there would be a change.
So there would be a change, right. That would have been a better way to have put that joke. Man, I am all sorts of crappy tonight. My jokes aren't working. My intro's not good. You don't have video.
Nobody needs to see me anyway.
I didn't pack my pipe very well. Oh, we could probably tell the folks that are listening at home that we're doing a pipe show tonight.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Tell them that.
Folks, we're doing a pipe show tonight.
And since I don't have video, nobody gets to see the fact that I'm lighting my pipe with a grill lighter tonight.
I was jazzed about that when you were describing it, hoping we'd be able to get video back. Oh, well. Yes, Kip has no video. He claims that he's lighting his pipe with a barbecue lighter, but I truly believe that we're going to hear a torch from him, and he has no know-how as to how to properly light a pipe. I am the expert on this show when it comes to pipe smoking. I think we can all agree upon that.
Hang on just a second.
He needs to start up the butane or the acetylene torch. We're ready.
I just sent you a picture.
Oh, you did? I don't believe it. Oh, I did get a picture. Let's see if we can share it. Have you lit your facial hair on fire to light the pipe? There's Kip. We have physical proof. There is evidence. What is flashing? Something is flashing on me. Oh, well. I don't know what it is, but hopefully it's not the self-destruct.
I got to say, this grill lighter idea seems to work better than the majority of pipe lighters I've tried. It's fantastic. It directs the flame where you need it. Got plenty of reach. Has a ginormous fuel tank. I'm thinking of converting.
You know, if you were really savvy and 20 years younger and wore skinny jeans, you would try to make it a business model, call it a startup, and all of a sudden you could sell those pipes for $427 because you made them in your garage and they were small batch.
Yeah, small batch, handcrafted, imported grill lighter, pipe lighters.
This show is not our best tonight.
Yeah, I could bedazzle them.
Oh, Lordy. I was reading a book on vacation. I don't know, when was I in Colorado? 3 weeks ago, something like that. And this weird female character in it, and she talked about bedazzling certain body parts. And I believe that term will forever only associate that terrible, terrible book.
Hmm.
Ay, ay, ay. Anyways.
Well, why would I be in skinny jeans?
Huh?
Why would I have to be in skinny jeans?
To be a hipster?
Well, I'm not certain they make skinny jeans in my size.
I am fairly certain in your size they can't make skinny jeans.
Yeah, they make some tight ones, I tell you that.
Every couple years, man, I do have skinny jeans. Well, we have a pipe night tonight. I believe this is pipe night number 4. You have it written as pipe night number 3. So either I enjoyed one of them twice as much, or the likely chances one of us is bad at counting.
Yeah, I'll double check before I post it.
I think the important part is that we're smoking a pipe tonight, not a cigar. Changing things up a little bit, and certainly ready to talk a bit more about, I don't know, the other half of tobacco files or tobacco geeks' passions. I think that's a safe way of putting it.
Yeah, and I'm somewhat nearby, actually right at the moment, just feet away from a third of my cellar of pipe tobacco, so it comes in handy.
Oh, only a third? Holy cow.
I split it between three friends when I left, so it didn't take up too much room in any one person's house.
Well, I have a room devoted to all things cigars and pipe tobacco, so if you ever make it up to Chicago, feel free to have at this space. If you can fill this space, I am impressed.
I did have a lot of pipe tobacco.
I saw, one of the owners of my company sent me an email today. It was a picture of like a crappy studio apartment with just every square inch of the floor stacked with dollar bills or whatever, with money. And the caption was, "Nigerian prince passed away this last weekend." he was left with billions of dollars in his apartment because no one had answered any of his emails for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
I hope that's what your pipe tobacco collection looks like.
Yeah, it was big. I sold a lot before we moved, but it was pretty big.
What is big in terms of tins? Are we talking 100 tins, 1,000 tins? Enough tins to where you shouldn't say that anything that's being recorded for sake of your divorce happening?
Well, my wife lived with me. She knew what I had around.
Well, that is true.
There were about 1,200 or so tins worth of tobacco there.
That's a lot of tins. Holy crap.
Yeah.
That's like 400 pounds of tobacco.
Yeah, I sold, well, more than half of that.
So you have 60 pounds of pipe tobacco in each of those homes, roughly.
Yeah.
That is, God bless you, son. Bravo.
Well, minus what I've been taking down for the past 4 years. I've been slowly muling it down.
Is your goal to get all of it down there?
Yeah, and probably never get all of it down there, but unless I have enough for today, I'm all right.
Well, I guess that makes sense. Yeah, somebody's asking, how many pallets is that? That is a very valid question.
Well, most of it was in tins, but no small part of it was in mason jars. I used to buy the half-pipe wide-mouth mason jars, stuff them. And I had cases and cases of mason jars stacked up in our closet back then.
I think that's pretty darn cool. Yeah. I'm sure that that's a pretty regular occurrence for anybody who's cellaring a lot of tobacco, but it seems neat to me to imagine that. To just imagine that you could look in a closet and literally you'd have feet covered in the closet.
Yeah.
Stacked high.
Yeah, and they come, you know, the things come in a little flat, the jars, so they stack easy, beautifully, nice little cubes. Or big cubes.
Or foot. So would you typically be buying by the pound, essentially?
Yeah, some blends were not available in bulk, but if I would find a blend that I really liked and wanted to put away and it was sold in bulk, I would just buy it in bulk and break it down into jars myself.
How did that affect aging?
Well, not at all. I mean, you buy the bulk, you put it into jars and seal them up, and long they're, you know, pretty similar to a 10 from that point on. And Dick's asking in the chat room, how many tins make a pound? A typical tin is either 50 or 100 grams. And so it's like 4.5 hundred gram tins or 9 50 gram tins is about a pound, roughly.
But it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to get larger amounts too, especially if you're buying by in bulk.
Right. I'm just talking about a tin size because that was what he asked. If you're buying bulk, typically if you're buying loose bulk from a supplier, from a tobacconist, you buy by the ounce, 2, 4, 8, 16 ounces. But if you're buying big packages, some blending houses sell it in bulk where you buy a pound or some do kilograms at a time.
So this is not related to Andex inevitably trying to check how bad my math was on the number of tins you have. It's actually something different. Have you ever, since we don't have a video, I guess I can't look at you, but have you ever retrohaled pipe tobacco while you're puffing it, while your mouth is still on the pipe?
Yeah.
So that's a completely normal thing for you?
Yeah. What I don't understand, I guess, what the point, what you're getting at.
Well, one, I'm changing the topic. It has no relation to the number of tins in a pound or whatever.
Okay.
I typically don't do that because pipe tobacco typically, it irritates my nasal passages a little bit more than cigar tobacco.
That's just so weird to me. I'm the complete opposite.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. That is strange to me. Because I would say if I had to speak in generalities, what I'm smoking today is early morning pipe from Dunhill. I would say this is the first tobacco that I can remember ever that I can retrohale while I'm just in the process of smoking it. I'm not taking smaller puffs in or retrohaling it very slowly.
Hmm. I am 180 degrees, total opposite. The cigars always, even the mildest of cigars, are much more aggressive through my nose than any of the pipe tobaccos.
Wow, that's really strange. Okay, I wonder why we are so different in that regard.
I don't know. This is going to sound even weirder because most people think of heavily flavored aromatics as tending to be milder in terms of their strength and the potency of the smoke itself. I don't want to say acidity, the fact that it can be acrid, but heavily flavored pipe tobaccos do burn my nose a bit more. They're very shrill because the flavoring sometimes gets bitter when it gets heated. And so it's a rare thing that I smoke a cased pipe tobacco, but that's one of the reasons, but those would be the ones that I would say bother me if there were any.
Hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. Okay. Well, alrighty. That's, I would imagine propylene glycol can have a lot to do with that. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And those blends tend to have a lot of it.
Hmm. So what are you smoking tonight? I am pretty unfamiliar with this.
I'm smoking a blend from McBaron called Burley London Blend. And having a difficult time because I have a little flap of tobacco that keeps sliding across the draft hole and I can't seem to get it out with a pot cleaner. But it is a, as you can guess by the name, a predominantly Burley blend. There is an assertion online in some places that there's some Virginia in it. And I kind of believe that, but I at the same time would say it's very, very mild and in the background. And I would say the exact same thing of the flavoring. I don't remember there even being a claim of a topping on this tobacco, but when I was kind of browsing around looking it up earlier today, I saw comments that there was a cocoa or chocolate topping on it. And I didn't get that back then, but you know, I haven't bought it in years. This was actually a mason jar that I opened up today or yesterday. And it was from January 23rd of 2005 is when I put it in the jar. Nothing like that. No, I don't recall any kind of flavoring like that. It was very nutty, slightly sweet, but it was more of a generic sugary kind of sweetness without any specific flavoring to it. And this, after sitting in the jar for all these years, it's still actually very similar. I won't say that it has radically changed, although it may be a little bit sweeter, a little bit more floral kind of a taste than I remember, but still pretty much like I remember it, which is peculiar, but not really surprising because Burley doesn't do a lot on its own. I don't have too much fear of the negative emails from that comment because most of the guys that smoke straight Burley are old codgers that don't use email. But, anyway, I used to reach for this blend quite a bit. I was never a huge Burley kind of guy. Well, I am kind of a Burley guy, but not wasn't into Burley tobacco. But when I did reach for it, this is what I would smoke. And I kept a good bit of it around and still do. Excuse me. I was saddened to learn that this blend was actually discontinued right around the time just before I moved to the Dominican Republic. It's been gone for several years now. I did not know that because I had a big supply. I had no reason to go looking for it to buy it. But thankfully, I have a good bit of it put aside because it's still good. I like it so far. I'm trying to come back to it because I've been talking too much. I'm about to let it go out.
No, that's fine. You nurse the bowl a little bit before you finish your whole description here, and I will ask you a question that came up. So my knowledge of tobacco is 99% cigar-related or cigar-focused in its origin or where I've gotten it. So the question that I have is about Burley, the tobacco itself. Do you think that it's something more akin to like a Connecticut shade grown wrapper where you're working with a thin, pretty, I shouldn't say weak, but a kind of a bland leaf. There's not a whole ton of substance to it. It's thin. It's pretty basic. It's not overly oily. So when you are fermenting it, curing and fermenting it, there's just not a lot of substance there in order to be able to go to the well, so to speak, and ferment to different levels of sweetness or flavor or depth or complexity.
Yeah. Burley's that hard, Burley? Physically is a hardy leaf. It's not a delicate little thing. It's a very common or a pedestrian kind of tobacco in this part of the world. It is probably the most commonly grown strain or varietal or whatever in Tennessee and Kentucky. And a big part of it goes into cigarettes. And Burley is often used as a framework kind of thing. It's not a condiment. It's not something that's going to lend a lot of flavor to a tobacco, but it gives a lot of body and it gives a good bit of strength. Burley, for whatever reason, its reputation is bigger than reality for being a strong tobacco in terms of its nicotine strength, and it can be, and sometimes is, but it doesn't provide just a whole lot of flavor. It's inherently, but it will suck up the flavor from anything around it and just kind of lend some consistency to a blend. In the old days, when I say the old days, in the older than now days, not in the ancient past, but up until the late 70s, early 80s, when pipe smoking was still a pretty common thing, especially in older guys, Burley was very, very common in the U.S., in the blends. Prince Albert, Walnut Street, Revelation, all those what people now call codger blends, what the old guys tend to like for decades, those were mostly built around Burley, and Burley was a dominant part of the blend when they would just use, you know, some other condiments to kind of spice it up a little bit. But Burley was very popular in that demographic because it's what they grew up with. You know, in the 1950s, English pipe tobaccos were not uncommon in the U.S., but in the places they were common were only in big cities and metropolitan areas where they were imported and carried. So all throughout most of the U.S., which was a little more rural, a little more, you know, outside of even being suburban, the only thing there was were some of these blends, and that's what people kind of cut their teeth on. So that's what they knew. It's what they stuck with. Because back in the day also, it seems to me, looking back, that most guys had a blend and that was what they smoked.
Yeah.
Same thing with cigarettes. You have guys that are Marlboro guys, they smoke Marlboros. When I was a kid, my grandfather smoked Prince Albert, and he would roll it up in a rolling paper. He would put it in his pipe, and it didn't really matter, but he smoked Prince Albert or something he or his cohorts had grown themselves. That was it. He didn't buy other blends. He didn't need to because he liked it. He didn't feel like he had to go try everything else.
I can understand that. Mm-hmm. So if you were to make your own pipe tobacco a la your grandfather, was he essentially just curing and putting a light ferment on a Burley or something? Mm-hmm. And that was it. He wasn't actually curing with herbs or spices or any sort of flavoring at all. Nothing was extravagant here. This was essentially just cigarette tobacco that he was smoking in a pipe.
Yeah, flue cured tobacco. If they were doing it themselves, I mean, both sides of my family worked tobacco for generations, just growing it on small farms and allotments when that system took place. But it would just go and either be air cured or flue cured, which kind of happens a lot in Kentucky still. But I don't know. That was kind of it. It was pretty straightforward. What today we know as just plain Burley or even some Bright, which is a Virginia Bright, what they call it. And that was kind of it. It's not like we were growing Latakia and smoldering it over camel dung.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting because you think about that. Well, you're always going to smoke what it is that you're familiar with, except those times when he and his cohorts would have something that they had grown. And I was thinking of it like that was a bit of an extravagant treat, but in reality, it was probably more. Well, now they just didn't have to pay for it; they had it on their own.
They would process it and cure it, and it's not like they didn't have an escaparate where they were storing cigars or anything like that. But typically, after it was done and ready, they just put it into a twist. I don't know if you know what a twist is.
Only from how you've described it before.
You kind of
you had one, right?
I still do. Yeah, you twist out a rope of tobacco and then kind of fold it over and give it another few twists. And you can still buy twists today in rural southeastern United States. I still see it sometimes in little stores around here or around Tennessee, not here in Florida. And you just carry that in your pocket. And if you want to chew it, you just cut a piece off and chew it. If you want to smoke it in your pipe, you just cut some little coins off and roll it out in your fingers and smoke it in a pipe. It's pretty versatile.
It's a whole other world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I grew up with tobacco in my family. We've talked about that before, but it was never, I never had blenders or people who were passionate about it. I had people who, it was their living. They were women in Ybor City. Well, what were they going to do if you were a woman in Ybor City looking for excess work? What did they have enough of? Well, you were a cigar roller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the conversations were always the same damn thing. Tia Kusa, she always had the most beautiful hands because it was the tobacco oil, the greatest moisturizer in the world. They were amazing. I can always remember how soft her hands were. Just like it was things like that, kind of the anecdotal stories of days gone by, not so much, flu curing over camel dung, as you so eloquently put it.
Well, no.
Not that that was your family either. I'm not saying that.
That is just to be clear before I start getting emails correcting me. There is an old wives' tale kind of thing that Latakia is cured over smoldering camel dung. So no, that's not a thing. certainly not what we did in East Tennessee. not a lot of camels left in Tennessee.
Well, I would have.
Maybe why we didn't make La Tequila.
I would have very much made a joke or two about you guys being more likely to do it over camel dung than they would have, but only because of the thriftiness of that region of the nation.
Yeah. Man alive. Speaking of the moisturizing thing, I remember when I was a kid, you were never very far from somebody smoking, chewing tobacco or whatever. And it seemed like all the old women always used snuff. And the high and dry, or high dry toast, that kind of snuff, which is the really flour powder kind of consistency, the cooking flour, not the plant.
Sure.
But rather than snorting it like normal people through the nose, they would put it in their lip the way guys would now dip Copenhagen or Skoll or something like that. They would keep a dip of snuff in their lip. And if you were a hillbilly kid in my youth and you got stung by a bee or something, there would be just for miles around people crawl out of the woodwork trying to rub tobacco spit on your bee sting.
I got to tell you, Kip, that did not happen in Chicago.
Well, it happened in East Tennessee. It happened to me a lot.
Oh, that. I love that story. That is awesome. Oh, gosh.
Once at a gathering at my mom's uncle's house when I was a kid, and they had woods out behind the house, and I was out playing in the woods and got into a yellow jacket's nest.
Ugh.
And just got stung, I don't know, 15 to 20 times just all over. And I came out there, and man alive, I looked like I had the measles when they got done with me, just rubbing shit all over me.
All right. I am lighting for the third time. I have to say.
Frank says that doesn't happen in Canada either. Well, I don't think it still happens in East Tennessee. Most of the... Even in East Tennessee, the tobacco use is not what it used to be.
I am absolutely falling prey to the idea of pipe tobacco smoking having a different cadence than smoking a cigar, because I am definitely letting this joker go out more than I should, and it's quite annoying.
It happens, and if it becomes bothersome and you're not developing the cadence naturally, you can just start drying your tobacco a little more. And it'll
help. I can do what to the tobacco leaf? I'm sorry.
Drying it a little more.
Oh.
But not too much, but a little more.
This probably only dried for half an hour before I bowled it, but I mean, it's much more of a... I'm fairly certain it's much more of an example of me not smoking it properly.
The other thing, you can really vary up the way you pack the bowl as well. I did not used to think, let me say this correctly. I have always known and believed that packing matters, and you could do it incorrectly, and it would impact the burn and the flavor and pretty much everything about a bowl of tobacco. But since I, this time, have kind of gotten back into pipes over the last few months, I have come to believe that packing has got to be right up there in one of the single most important things in smoking a bowl. And I have toyed around with how I'm packing the pipe. And even though I consider myself a lighter packing person when I'm putting tobacco into a bowl, I have even considerably upped that game a little bit to where I am just not compressing the tobacco a whole lot at all. I do rub out my tobacco into the finest pieces possible, very finely, but I will just kind of drizzle it into the bowl and tap the side of the bowl with my finger to kind of settle it down and compress it just a smidge and do that a couple more times. And I'm compressing very little, and the bowl doesn't last as long. There's not as much tobacco in it, but I rarely have any problems with moisture. Don't have problems with the burn right now. I'm kind of getting back into my groove these days.
It's interesting to hear you say that. I have a couple tins by me that I've been looking at, and there's some things that I have on pipe tobacco, and some of them say that I don't have them exactly in front of me. I just have one tin right in front of me that I'm looking at, but talking about how there are different methods for the packing. And one of the things that I'm thinking this alludes to is that your tobacco or your pack is more dependent on your tobacco than what?
Absolutely.
Now that's really interesting to me. I would have never thought that.
How so?
Well, you're going to try to get the tobacco in the shape of what it needs to be to smoke properly. Slightly dry, rubbed out, even consistent or somewhat consistent piece size. So then if you had tobacco A and tobacco B that you had done that with, I would think that you would be able to smoke the, or pack those in a similar manner because you've essentially accounted for some of those variables. And I've just never gotten enough into it to think that, well, it might look the same and be the same saturation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's the same amount of oils in it. And so you might need to smoke one with more air or less air or faster cadence or slower cadence. Well, and it's really interesting to me that that's the case.
Well, if you think about it, like I have fairly well rubbed out this tobacco. It comes in kind of a really well broken flake, and so it has some bigger pieces, but I have rubbed it out into very fine pieces. And if you think about sediment, you're a sediment kind of guy, you deal with construction and drainage in particular. If you have a sediment that is poorly sorted, I mean, you have several different sizes of sediment. The smaller pieces are going to fall into the little cracks and holes and crannies and not really let a lot of water through. And it's like that with your airflow. If you have a tobacco that's poorly sorted, you have, you know, everything from half a millimeter to 5 millimeter pieces, then mm-hmm. the smaller ones are going to shake down into the nooks and crannies and it's not going to flow as properly. But if you can have a more uniform size, then those little spaces are going to remain unfilled and let the air pass through, just like water through sediment.
It all sounds good in theory, Kip.
Sure. It applies to everything.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, communism sounds great on paper, but have trouble when you get people involved.
We can make it work without people. Well, anyways, it always has kind of, whenever I've seen things like this, I've thought of it as more of a marketing piece, let's say. You know, I don't really look to cigar paraphernalia for proper ways to cut a cigar, you know, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. It's just, I don't know. I always thought that, yeah, well, once you get into it, once you know what you need, that's going to trump what they're telling you. But I don't know, maybe it's kind of a combination of all of that.
Yeah, you don't need a whole lot for pipe smoking.
No, my
dad didn't even bother to carry a tamper. He just used his finger. Got a lighter and a finger, he was good to go. I got to have tamper, pipe cleaners, lighter, matches, whole pocket full of crap.
let me get my video back on here. I have two lighters, neither of which are soft flame, that I have to use in tandem in order to light my pipe, because said lighter one has no working spark. Said lighter two has no spark, but it will not ignite itself. So you need fuel from lighter one and spark from lighter two and the proper angle to get a soft flame on lighter two. Mm-hmm. Your soft flame then applied to said bowl and puff, puff, you're lit and you're good to go. So I have a feeling if your lovely father was still around, he would shake his head and walk out of the room if he ever saw me pussyfooting around with all my accoutrements.
You know, I have been using matches almost exclusively for the past few months with a pipe. Just because I can't find any frickin' fuel around Santiago right now.
I'm showing the chat room one of the things that I'm reading because they're apparently wondering if I'm reading a book.
What was that?
John Bull pack of pipe tobacco.
Oh.
Some of the verbiage and such on here, and then another tin and whatever. They think you're boring, Kip, and that I need to find a book.
That's fine. A lot of people think that.
I just shouldn't have clicked on the chat room. why not? Guys, make me laugh. There we go. Chat room, go. Well, it occurs to me that I haven't really gotten into some of the specifics about my early morning pipe, which I should also mention. I am using, actually, a pipe that I bought from you, I believe. 7LE Punto Oro.
Uh-huh.
Which, I love this pipe. I have four pipes, and I reach for this almost all the time.
Yeah.
That's a narrow cool bowl, nice little pipe, a little bit of cake on it, nothing crazy. Flat bottom, I don't need anything. Don't need to worry about setting it anywhere. It just always stays. I love this little pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And a deep bowl, though, but narrow. Just a little bit wider than my tamper. Probably a half inch or so. Smokes really well for most of the Virginias that I smoke. This is not a Virginia. It's actually an English.
That's funny. But,
it is actually an English, but it smells very much like a Virginia. It reminds me a lot of what you would just think of as what pipe tobacco would smell like. If you ever grew up with somebody smoking a pipe, this just reminds me of that. It's classified as an English, as I said, but it does smell more like it has a Virginia core, which is odd to me.
That's kind of common.
Is it?
Yeah. Virginias often are for people who are not really into Burleys, Virginia becomes the base, the foundation for the blend, and it's decorated with the condiments of those Oriental tobaccos.
So I would say that that is exactly what this is. It is very sweet in aroma. I don't know if it's, well, not very sweet in aroma. It's much more akin to what I would associate being Virginia tobacco than the smoky Orientals in aroma. And as I've smoked it, the bowl, which was pretty full when I packed it, the bowl is actually transitioning a little bit. It is getting much smokier as I'm getting further into it, which is unexpected. I don't know if that's a super common phenomena, but it seems to be the case for me as I use my multiple lighter get up to.
You know, I don't know what I think about that. And I'll tell you why I say that.
Go right ahead.
I remember back in the day, people breaking down pipe tobacco reviews in the same way, into thirds, the way you would do a cigar, maybe. And I never really felt like that was heavily influenced so much by the tobacco. You know, it'll change because the smoke's going through different things. It's heating up the tobacco before it burns. It maybe has a little moisture or whatever. But It's a mix that is the mix, at least, is consistent or should be consistent throughout the bowl. It's not like somebody can put, you know, if you're making a cigar, maybe you cut the trim off one end and you put it back near the head of the cigar. And maybe when you get to that point, you're burning. Now that's a different blend. That's a different mix of tobaccos is burning. And pipe tobacco is not really the same way if you're smoking it rubbed out anyway. Maybe a flake could be or something like that. But I think more of the differences and transitions within a bowl of pipe tobacco happen due to the circumstances rather than the blend itself.
Yeah, additional drying heat. If you've got an air channel where it just happens that a certain buildup of a couple leaves of, or whatever the term would be, leaves of the same tobacco type are actually what you're pulling through is the majority of the smoke. I could see exactly what you're saying. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, that's all speculation on my part. I don't know how real it is. It's just what I think. Just my opinion. Make it yours.
I don't think it sounds like an uneducated opinion, though.
Yeah. Eating a blind hog finds an acorn every once in a while.
Can't you just talk about squirrels and nuts? Yeah, hillbilly. Well, this tobacco has a little bit of a story for me. I know that I have mentioned that my pipe smoking started at the cigar store where I really grew my cigar smoking enjoyment into a passion. They sold Dunhill and CAO tobaccos in the late 90s, early aughts. So that's what I'd smoked. And I'm fairly certain, though not positive, that this early morning pipe was one of the blends that was there. And it's just nostalgic to me. It's mm-hmm. the type of flavors that I enjoy. I really can't say that I have a lot of experience with Burley. I do enjoy some English, but for me, English is a bit more of a fascination isn't the right word. An indulgence, perhaps. When I'm looking for something different, Latakia just quenches that thirst. But my normal smoking experience is going to be something more akin to a Virginia. And this just puts me back there. I really enjoy that.
If I remember right, the early morning pipe just has the tiniest little bit of actual Latakia. There are some other Orientals that appear in there, but it was, like I said earlier, it was built on a Virginia base with just some condiments in it.
I think that's a great way of putting it, and I'm noticing the Latakia more in the room aroma than I am in the smoking experience. Mm-hmm. That typical Latakia, smoky, thick, just almost pervasive. It's mm-hmm. kind of what I imagine the couple of you on the forum who've spoken of Perique in the last couple of weeks, kind of how I'm imagining that, not tasting the same way, because I obviously have no way to associate those two, the tastes of those two tobaccos, since I've not had Perique, but just how it can be so overpowering, and you would never smoke a bowl of straight Latakia, I would imagine, very much the similar of how you've described Perique.
Yeah, Perique is a really interesting tobacco. It's grown in one parish in Louisiana. And Percy Martin in the early 2000s was over 90 years old and was the last remaining Perique farmer on the planet. There were no more. And the majority of what you saw marketed as Perique was not. It was Green River Burley that was processed similarly as Perique. And for the fermentation, they take it and push it into barrels with a giant press and just press and press and press under huge amounts of pressure and let it ferment during that, in that barrel that way. And it gives it a really unique flavor and a very unique aroma, that's for sure. And so in those early 2000s, I, through some various contacts, got an address for Percy Martin. And wanted some of his Perique because I knew most of what I was getting in other blends was not actually what Perique had been for the past few centuries. And I just wanted to freaking know. So I went and bought a $50 money order and put it in an envelope with a letter to him and said, hey, you know, I'd really like to try it. If there's any way that I can get some of your tobacco, I'd love for you to send me some. Here's some money. If it's not possible, just enjoy it and have a night out or something. 95 years old. So
get yourself a new chair for your front porch. You inevitably sit on.
I dropped that in the mail, and several weeks later, 3 pounds of whole leaf Perique showed up in the mailbox. And so I took that stuff and opened it up, and man alive, it smelled like a horse stall. I mean, just the muskiest, dankest kind of tobacco. The barnyard doesn't even begin to describe it. And I sat at my kitchen table with a steak knife or a carving knife and chopped that into little shreds and filled up jars with it and used it to experiment with all kinds of stuff for years. And that reminds me, my friend Billy has what I have left of my Percy Martin Perique in a blend I was making at the time. I need to see if I can round some of that up. Most of his production at that time, if not all of it, some years, all of it went to that Native American Spirit, the cigarette company. All of his Perique was going out to them. And so pretty much everything sold as Perique in pipe tobacco was not actually Perique. And there was a lot of concern that it was going to disappear completely when he died. But I believe his family has carried on with it. They're still making some. And heck, I don't know what happens with it these days.
Is there... it strikes me as pipe tobacco or pipe smoking strikes me as an industry where tradition is so much more important than even what we expect in cigar making or cigar industry. Is that correct?
I think it can be. I think at a consumer level, definitely. When you tell a pipe smokers that a blend is going to go away, it will be utter chaos. And I mean, I've seen it countless times when the news breaks that this blend is going off the market or they've lost their importer, it's not coming to the U.S. or whatever. It takes about 30 minutes until every tin of that tobacco in the United States is sold, is gone. When you encounter it after that, it's a big deal. Over and over. And the pipe smokers tend to be people with personalities that don't like change. They just don't.
So the next logical question to me would be if there could ever be, I'll say groundswell, but with the fact that, you know, there's 30 or 40 American pipe smokers left, it seems, groundswell is probably a bit aggressive of a term, but could there ever be any way that that industry could support some sort of standardization of, if you say you have Burley, it must be Burley. If you say you have Perique, it must be Perique. Could that ever happen?
I don't know. And, you know, I don't know. St. James Parish is where Perique was always grown historically. And I know they tried some of the protections like bourbon. You know, when if it's not made in Kentucky, you can't call it bourbon or whatever, but I don't know if that ever
counties.
I don't know if it ever took root or there could even be some kind of enforcement, but I don't know.
One of the things that I've been curious about in the cigar industry is since someone somewhere somehow has to have a record of what you're putting into your cigar, assuming the FDA regulations move forward as discussed. Mm-hmm. Since it's being done, would there ever be a next logical step of some non-governmental agency taking that very same information and almost trademarking blends? I'm curious if that could ever happen. I mean, you can't get a bourbon unless it's from a small cluster of counties in Kentucky. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Could there ever be? Well, let's talk about cigars. You can't have a Cuban cigar, an Habano, unless it's from Pinar. The tobacco is from Pinar del Rio. There is a cigar manufactured. It might be the Guantanamera cigar. Guantanamera, I believe. Cuban Guantanamera, which the tobacco is not all from Pinar del Rio. There are some diehard Cuban cigar smokers who say that the Guantanamera is not actually an Habano because it's not all tobacco from Pinar del Rio.
Hmm.
So I'm curious if we could see this sort of a logical step. So the vintage 1992 actually has to have tobacco from 1992 in it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Are we ever going to see that? Could we ever see it? Could that happen because the pipe tobacco industry would ever get behind something of that nature where Perique is Perique is Perique, not Green Mountain Burley?
That's hard to say. And it may be a moot point because the really big blending houses that are pumping out tons of bulk tobacco would, if they decide it's feasible and makes sense financially, would continue. But the smaller guys that make other tobacco, some of these things we talk about and smoke ourselves, I think they're probably going to go away. And we've already seen that. I mean, McClellan was one of the bigger pipe tobacco producers in the United States, and they closed shop. They just, like, you know, they just can't manage the requirements that are coming. It just didn't make sense anymore. And they were already somewhat crippled on principle alone. And I admire them for what they did, but it was a foot into a grave, and the FDA kind of sealed the deal where they reached a point they were not able to get a significant blending component that made up a big part of many, many of their blends. So they put a letter out to the retailers and said, look, we are not happy with anything we're able to procure right now. It doesn't produce the product that we have been making since, you know, the last four decades. So we're just going to put those blends on hold. They're not going to be available until the time comes that we're able to get something of a good enough quality that satisfies what we want to make. And so that hurt them financially. I mean, they couldn't make those tobaccos, and it was a big part of their production. And in the midst of that, the FDA stuff comes down, and they just threw in the towel last April, a year ago, I guess. And we've seen McClellan pipe tobacco has just gone astronomical on the secondary market. People paying stupid amounts of money for McClellan tobacco now. But of course that doesn't help McClellan any. And I think a lot of the other guys, the other smaller blending houses, are going to go the same way. I don't know what their strategies are, how they're going to weather the American market troubles. Some of the foreign producers have adjusted. I mean, much of the UK and Europe has had pretty stringent controls for years, and many of them don't depend on the US market. I mean, good grief, even the Gawith houses, Samuel Gawith and Gawith and Gawith Hogarth, two big English houses. I don't know what their numbers are. I don't have a clue, but I do know their tobaccos seem to rarely make it in any real supply to the U.S. So they're not depending on the U.S. for the market. I think they'll be okay. But the McClellans, Greg Pease sells a crap ton of pipe tobacco, but I don't know what it means when tradition meets regulation. You know, how do you even sort through those regulations when all these different things that we call, all these different names we call these tobaccos, what do they even mean in a legal sense? Because it's all the same plant, it, you know, has different processing methods, different handling methods. It would be a matter of like a cigar of testing a finished blend if you had to do the lab work and publish the components and the breakdown of how much nicotine content per gram or whatever. So I don't know. Who's going to decide what the actual legal definition of Perique is? And that's kind of a no-brainer because pretty limited in scope, but how do you say, what is a Virginia Bright? What is a Red Virginia? A Red Virginia is a pretty loose term that's thrown around for not much more than a shade of color. What does it mean in terms of its history of processing? What does it mean in its flavor? What does it mean in its chemical composition? And none of those things exist. It's just, oh, that's Red Virginia. That's just what it is. That's a Yellow Virginia. That's just what it is. There's not a lot of detail that exists, as far as I know, to even classify these things into what they are.
I don't know. Maybe it's the zeal that I have to not be content if something can be better or more. Defined isn't the right word, but if you can have more integrity in it, all right, mm-hmm. That's a pretty generic or broad way of putting it, but it covers the bases. If you got to do the work anyways, you're not forcing yourself to have to do something you otherwise wouldn't. All you're essentially doing is establishing a level of integrity that you have no matter what already. You're not doing anything different. You're just essentially making it so that way you are, I don't know, putting some sort of insurance out there. Mm-hmm. Joe customer, you are getting this and it's proven now. You can't get this from the guy who's charging half price and calling it the same thing.
Right. And I don't know. That's the only reason I think it may be a moot point is I don't think long-term that the majority of these small and mid-sized producers are going to survive.
True.
I mean, we worry about the cigar companies, but many of them are
huge in comparison to these pipe tobacco.
They're enormous because most pipe tobacco blending companies are just small family operations. It's not like, you know, a big sales force is out there or trying to move product. It's not like there's a staff of hundreds working in a factory. This is, you know, 8 or 10 people. They can make a lot of pipe tobacco. You have one guy who has a library of information in his head, and when he dies, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I suppose that you could look at that as either the good or the bad with it, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. It's just an interesting conversation to have and to consider. Nobody's going to have to do extra work at that point to make something like that a reality. Yeah. It will all be done. You are going to have a third-party organization that's essentially industry oversight, not non-governmental. Nobody's saying anything about government here. It just seems like it might prop up those who are doing it right, air quotes, more than the other guys. But
yeah, I just don't know if the pipe tobacco world has the clout for that now.
Totally an option. I absolutely think that could be true.
Yeah. I mean, the market is just, there's nothing. We saw some interesting numbers over the past few years. Since the late 60s, early 70s, the pipe tobacco market has dwindled to nothingness, relatively speaking, is year after year. And there was a surprising spike 4 or 5 years ago where it's, oh, wow, look at that. The sales and usage numbers went up. Oh, they went up again this year. Well, no, what happened was you roll your own tobacco guys are calling it pipe tobacco, and those get numbers, and what you have are cigarette smokers that can roll their own cigarettes, and it looks like pipe tobacco. The last number I saw was basically 0.5% of the adult male population in the U.S. smokes a pipe. You got 1 out of every 200 guys that smoke a pipe. You're not going to sell 100 tons of pipe tobacco, no matter how good the blend is.
Okay, I am moving on to my second bowl of tobacco. That first one was finished.
I just did a charring light myself.
Well, so I am packing this in the manner of your recent discussion. I drizzled over it, tapped against the side of the of my hand to let it kind of compress itself naturally. Did it again, tapped, did it again until it was filled to the point where tapping it kind of knocked tobacco out. I then have just slightly compressed it a little bit so it wasn't just super loose. Do I give it a charring light, tamp it, and then give it a light again? And then that's how you have been lighting?
Yeah, pretty much. One other thing I sometimes do, I will take kind of the dust. Like when I get out pipe tobacco, I'll usually put it, I have a little wooden bowl that's only about an inch deep and 6 or 7 inches across that I keep on my desk, and I'll just put some out there and rub it out into whatever consistency.
I'm using this.
Yeah, just like that.
Divided. It's like that today.
Somewhere in there after I've kind of rubbed it, there will be some dust, tobacco dust. And I will shake the bowl on an angle until that dust has settled down and then pull back the bigger pieces. And I'll put some of that dust on top, kind of act like kindling and or tinder, and it helps with the lighting. I actually used to make tobacco pouches that had a little sifter, like a sieve in the bottom on one end, and it would sieve out those little pieces, and so you could open the bottom of the pouch and shake those on top of your bow.
That's ingenious. Wow. Yeah. All right, I'm going to char this, so vamp for me, because we all know that me getting a lighter to ignite is not a quick thing.
Yeah, I wish the whole world could see the video feed of this lighter phenomena that's going on here. Well, while you're doing that, I'll go ahead and talk a little bit about this one, because we're an hour into the show and haven't really talked about what we're smoking outside of what it is. I made some notes noted in the notes that this was kind of a workhorse blend for me. It's nothing fancy, very straightforward. I always believed it was solely burley until I later learned that there was some small amount of Virginia in it. I never encountered anything I would have called a topping or casing, but looks like it may have had some at some point. When I opened this jar yesterday and just gave it a sniff, it smelled very much the same, a little sweeter, like I said earlier, a little more floral, and it's smoking much, much the same. And what I love about this pipe tobacco and why I always wanted to keep it around was because of what I just said, of it being a workhorse blend. It's something that I was happy to just sit in the dark and enjoy on the patio. I was happy if I was tying flies. I was happy if I was planning or building or doing something. It didn't matter. It's kind of a jack of all trades. I can enjoy it while I'm paying attention. It's interesting enough. I can enjoy it when I'm not particularly paying attention. It's just kind of an addition to the moment of whatever's going on. And so that's kind of the reason I have lamented the knowledge that it was discontinued. And I've been kind of looking around for anybody who's interested. I am not familiar with this other blend from McBaren. It's called Golden Extra. I am familiar with the blend. I've seen it, but I'm not familiar in the sense I have not smoked it. I may have at some point, but if I did, it's never been a regular thing for me. But I saw a number of people draw that comparison and make that as a recommendation for a replacement for it. But so if you're interested in pretty straightforward, slightly nutty, slightly sweet, with some age floral kind of thing in a burley blend, that may be something to explore. Another one I'd recommend is also a McBaren blend. And it's kind of peculiar that I mentioned both of these, because they're only one or two other McBaren blends I've ever smoked that I could smoke reliably without burning the crap out of my tongue. And one of the others is Navy Flake. And
one of the others is what?
Navy Flake.
Oh, okay.
And there are probably a dozen or more blends out there called Navy Flake, because historically it was a style rather than just a specific thing. Navy Flakes or Navy, quote unquote, Navy tobaccos were typically topped with a little bit of rum. And the legend behind it would say that tobacco was carried from the New World to England in spent rum casks, and they would kind of pick up some of that flavoring on the way, and it just became a thing. And so people started to add a little flavor with rum purposefully. I don't know how true that is, because I wasn't around 300 years ago to see, but almost. I do know that most Navy Flakes do have some amount of rum added to them just as a flavoring agent. But McBaren's Navy Flake in particular is really good. I really like it. It does need to be dried out some to avoid the tongue bite, but it's not too terrible. That's another good burley. And quite honestly, of the cheap drugstore tobaccos out there, Prince Albert's not a bad place to go. It is light and airy. It's not overly slathered in glycol. It smokes well. It's cut in a very fine, almost a shag cut, so it burns exceptionally well. It's plain tobacco, and it's honest tobacco. It's very straightforward and nutty. You can't go wrong with it. I mean, it's usable. It's serviceable. Anyway, and that's kind of where this one is. It's a very good tobacco for no particular reason, but for a lot of intangible reasons, and I really dig it. I'm digging this bowl tonight. But I do have to say that holding in the tradition of burley not being a thing that people say is for aging, it's not radically changed in the 14 and a half years since I put this in the jar. It's not gone through some miraculous transformation. It's very much like it was when I put it in there. It's just, and that's okay by me because I liked it then, so I like it now.
Well, my second bowl is DC's finest, John Bull, Royal English Pipe Tobacco. And as I had mentioned earlier, this apparently does have burley in it. So I have smoked burley. John Bull to me is less of an English than a lot of the other English that I've smoked. Whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. But that's kind of what I am thinking of if I'm just looking for the tip of the spear, so to speak, with kind of the smoky and this says Black Cavendish, but I could not pick out Black Cavendish. I don't have the palate to do that yet. This is a good compromise here.
Cavendish is not, people talk about it as if it is a variety or a type of tobacco, but that is a method of processing tobacco where it is pressed and steamed, and the steaming, I call it cooking the tobacco, kind of sweetens it a little bit. So it lends a sugary kind of sweetness. It's not a flavored sweetness. It's just a generic kind of sweetness added to the tobacco. So that's what it lends to a blend. It tempers a blend with some sweetness.
Well, I think that I might enjoy John Bull over your average English. Don't send me letters. I certainly don't know enough about pipe tobacco to know whether I'm offending anyone. But I might reach a little bit more for that because I think that bit of sweetness plays up some of the soft spots I have in my heart for a sweeter pipe tobacco and a sweeter cigar tobacco. I generally enjoy sweeter cigars and sweeter pipes. So that does clarify a thing or two, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Well, I like the John Bull. It's a nice, inexpensive English. Definitely a nice one for me.
Like it better than the John Bull cigar.
I like it better than John Bull cigars. That is correct. Well, we have covered an unexpectedly large amount of pinball-type pipe tobacco discussions.
Yeah.
Shall we?
For a night with no notes.
It's a be still my beating heart. Shall we talk a little bit about what we've smoked since our last recording and then close us out?
Sure. I can do that. I only have one thing on my list. I have a peculiar choice for me.
You do.
So why don't you tell us about your first two? Because there is some tie that binds those two cigars.
There is. So, I don't know. 2 weeks ago, right after our last show, probably, I send Kip a note letting him know, hey, I've got a couple cigars to smoke today. Why don't you pick? I'm not sure what I want. They're both very different. So, the cigars that I send him a photo of are the Quesada 40th Anniversary, and a, that's roughly a Toro, and a Gurkha Park Avenue, which is kind of a non-Cuban Churchill size. Well, in jest, I believe Kip sends me some sort of smart aleck response. Seriously? You're asking this between Quesada and Gurkha? Come on. And he doesn't even tell me which he would choose if it was up to him. He just makes me feel like a schmuck for even asking the question. So thanks, Kip. Appreciate that. And I know, of course, that Kip is therefore requesting I smoke the Quesada.
So, no, it sounds like you didn't know that. So maybe I meant the Gurkha.
Yeah, or maybe not. So, boy, oh boy. I think your packing method sucks, Kip. I'm going to blame you for how I can't keep this lit.
Mm-hmm.
So I light up the Quesada, and, you know, I'm going with it for a half an inch or so, and I'm slightly feeling, I don't know, underwhelmed is an easy choice, but probably more accurate is perplexed. I'm not getting much out of this cigar. It's a little woody, a little Nicaragua-y, and not much else. It's a fine burn, decent construction, looks beautiful, but I'm not getting a whole ton to it. I smoked this thing down probably 3 inches of this Toro, and it does not really improve, does not really change. It just, it has medium to medium high strength, some of that woodsy Nicaraguan core, and that's it. And I have to say, I was really unimpressed with this. I'm sure I have had some of the 40ths in the past, but man, this was not a great experience. So, yeah, even Paul May in the chat room. Quesada, duh. Yes, I know, duh. Except this wasn't a great example. I was really, really shocked. So that was unfortunate. So, of course, I made Kip feel terrible about his horrendous choice. And then halfway through the cigar, he proceeds to tell me, oh, yeah, after those had been manufactured for a couple years, they lost their luster to me. I don't know if something changed or if my palate changed, but anyways, they're not so good anymore. Bye. Yeah, that was his parting words to me on that one. So
I'm pretty sure I talked about that on the show like a year and a half ago.
Did you say anything last week? Because I might have a chance of remembering that. A year and a half ago, come on. So I was slightly unimpressed with that one. Kind of had a little bit of the air let out of my sails. And so this week, I didn't bother to ask Kip. I just reached for that Gurkha Park Avenue. If you're unfamiliar with this, it is essentially a million-dollar gorgeous Connecticut Shade wrapper on this Park Avenue. And it just looks like $1 million. Lit it up, and immediately I wanted to send Kip a bill for my time for picking that Quesada first, because this Park Avenue was a delight. It was sweet with some baking spice to it. It transitioned a little bit more to a citrusy twang. And then it finished not in the greatest way. With about 3 inches left, it was okay, but it wasn't certainly unappetizing. It was a fine cigar. It left my palate a little heavily polluted for being a mild cigar, so to speak. But I was really pleased with how it was performing. And knowing that Gurkhas can at times be found for pennies on the dollar with some of the big name retailers, it would be one that I would recommend if you can pick up a decent sized cigar for $3 a stick. This is a hell of a $3 cigar, if that would ever be possible. So the Park Avenue was not a grand slam by any stretch of the imagination, but a solid double. That was an enjoyable cigar. I was shocked. So thanks for your terrific recommendation, Kip.
You got it, but I feel like I'm calling BS on that story.
I think I actually sent you pictures of that cigar while it was happening.
You did, but I'm still not buying.
You know me, that if it's not good, I'm not going to smoke it. I enjoy smoking when it is enjoyable. If it's just a habit, I'll eat a sandwich if I'm looking for a habit. I don't need it to be a cigar.
And that habit's not any more healthy.
Yeah, well.
Well, the only thing I got on my list this time around is a cigar I would not normally smoke. It was given to me, and it is the Davidoff Escurio, which is, I believe, not ancient. It's one of their more recent releases.
Well, I bet it's 5 years, though.
Really? Okay. Well, by that, I didn't think it was that old, but you're probably right. You keep up with Davidoff more than me. But I got to tell you, knowing the typical pricing structure of Davidoff and knowing this is a $20-ish dollar cigar or more for the Gran Turo, which is what it was, which may not be the normal thing I would pick anyway. It's like 5.5 by 58, something like that. I was not super happy with it. It burned wonky. Mm. Didn't want to burn on one side. It tasted like every other Davidoff I ever smoked, which is fine enough, but I don't find them interesting enough to ever have explored their range to go out of my way to do it. But yeah, if it had been a $10 cigar, I would have been disappointed. I got through, you know, half of it, maybe a little more, and just put it down. It didn't do anything for me. It tasted okay. I enjoyed the flavor to the extent that, yeah, it was a cigar, and didn't really do a lot for me. And it certainly did not behave. But you know, maybe that was the conditions. I don't know what kind of conditions it was kept in before I got it. That could have impacted the burn or whatever. But yeah, it struggled and did not leave a lasting good impression on me to make me actually want to go buy some of them.
I am really, really surprised by that. I mean, I have, it looks like 2015, so okay. 4 years, not five.
Even that's still longer back than I thought. But I believe you.
I'm not overly familiar with this cigar. If I recall correctly, this is their foray into Brazilian tobacco, correct?
I believe so, yeah. It had Montefina in it.
All right. I don't know if I've had it. If I have, I've had one or two only. I do like some of the more recent Davidoff releases, the Nicaragua, the red-banded one. It doesn't matter. They have performed pretty admirably in my book. I'm surprised that this was not a great experience for you. It's too bad.
I was also given a Davidoff Nicaragua, one of those tiny little teeny tiny like bullets, just a very small
cigar.
And a box pressed Davidoff Nicaragua, which I have never smoked before. So see how that goes. I think I have those with me. I may smoke those before our next show.
Well, I love the Nicaragua. I think the Davy Nicaragua line is a real winner. That is excellent.
Cool. I remember I smoked them when they launched. That was one of the things at one of the Chattanooga tweet-ups, where it's this little flask / cigar holder tube that they gave out, and it had one of the Davidoff Nicaraguas in it. I smoked it and had a couple since then. I do enjoy those, or have enjoyed those every time. Never had a problem with them. They're not, golly, I'm going to get crap over this, but I'm a lot of Davidoff cigars come across as just milk toast to me. They're just, they're more delicate than what I usually reach for. I guess I, being a hillbilly redneck kind of guy, I'm not so genteel and sophisticated. I'm not a sophisticated man. And so I'm not a huge Davidoff fanboy kind of guy, but I'll have one every once in a while. I probably would not buy the Escurio. I would buy the Nicaragua based on my past experience.
Well, nothing wrong with that. I would also say the same, not because I'm experienced enough with the Escurio to deem it as unworthy, but because I find that Nicaragua to be just a winner. I think that's a great cigar, great blend for them.
Yeah. Hey, you know, when that they gave out those little flasks, they were selling them at the time for some ridiculous amount of money. But I kind of pooed on the idea because it was a very small aluminum tube, very well made, well designed, but I didn't think it was that useful. It wouldn't hold a very big cigar. Okay, I don't smoke a lot of big cigars. That's fine. It has a flask on one end, but the flask was essentially the volume of a shot glass. It was very tiny, like a little inch and a half section of the tube was blocked off. Make it. However, I'm not a flask guy. Not me. But they have released this new one that is the coolest thing. It looks like a typical kind of flask, but there's an around the edges of the thing is a strip of metal that goes entirely around it that's fastened in the center of each end, and it twists to reveal cigars on either side, and the flask is down the center. It looks really cool. Okay. Looks like Craig has lost power and froze up, so I will not so organizedly wrap out the show. We certainly appreciate you guys tuning in with us tonight, whether you're here in the chat room or somewhere down the road. We certainly appreciate you giving your time to listen up to us. And if you want to come back around next time for episode 198, I believe we'll be smoking an Unbanded that, if I'm not mistaken, came from Jay Ledoux. But in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, you can get us by email to greg@halfashed.com or kip@halfashed.com or any of the typical social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or our own little forum. Craig's bio, Dale Roush words. Good night, everybody, and thanks for tuning in.